The name of our podcast, Tech Sequences, is really a mashup of two words, technology and consequences. We are fascinated by the consequences, intended or unintended, of the internet and related technologies for the way we live, play, and work. We are your hosts, Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. We started our careers at the dawn of the internet and have been friends, colleagues, and comrades in arms for the better part of 20 years. In this podcast, we examine the impact internet-related technologies have made or may make in our lives. I'm Alexa Rod.
And I'm Leslie Daigle.
Welcome to Tech Sequences. As we sit here today, Ukraine, a fledgling democracy, is under attack, both physically with tanks and troops shelling its major cities, but also digitally with multiple Russian disinformation and propaganda campaigns attempting to paint Ukraine and its government officials as the aggressors in the Russo-Ukrainian relationship. Information manipulation by the Russian state may not be as shocking since they are credited with perfecting the propaganda playbooks as far back as the Bolsheviks. What is perhaps just as troubling is that Ukraine is not the only democracy under attack. In fact, democracies all over the world are under attack by digital, if not physical, warfare. Just a few episodes ago, in January of 2022, we had a conversation with Professor Phil Howard of Internet Studies at Oxford University about the normalization of what he calls computational propaganda by political operatives around the world and its consequences for civic discourse, the nature of truth, and of course, elections. Elections are increasingly targeted for disinformation campaigns designed to manipulate opinions and to question the integrity and fairness of the process itself. If free and fair elections are the lifeblood of democracies, then destabilizing elections via digital information manipulation is nothing less than the bloodletting of democracy. If digital election manipulation is something we should expect as a matter of course, are there ways to combat it in the short term? And how can we build resilience? Are there answers in what we may be able to do in the playbooks of the threat actors themselves?
Our guest today is Samantha Bradshaw. Samantha completed her PhD at the Oxford Internet Institute, where she also worked as a core member of the research team on the Computational Propaganda Project, and as a research associate at the Center for International Governance Innovation in Waterloo, Canada, on the Global Commission for Internet Governance. She is currently a postdoctoral research fellow at Stanford University, working at the Center for Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law, the Digital Civil Society Lab, and the Program for Democracy and the Internet. She's also a partner fellow with the Siegel Family Endowment. Samantha is joining the faculty of the American University School of International Service in the fall of 2022. Her scholarship uses a mix of computational and qualitative methods to answer foundational questions about technology, politics, and power. When do digital technologies enhance or constrain democracy, and which policy interventions are most needed to improve online information ecosystems? Her research and writing have been featured in New York Times, The Washington Post, CNN, The Financial Times, and Bloomberg Magazine. In addition, Samantha has leveraged her research and expertise to provide expert witness testimony to several ongoing political processes about the effects of technology on democracy. Welcome, Samantha.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me today.
I want to start by saying that we're here to talk about a study you co-authored on information manipulation in elections. But with events this year, we're rapidly learning that the state-sponsored information manipulation is increasingly a tool being used beyond election cycles. For example, in the so-called freedom convoys in Canada recently, and Russia's invasion of the Ukraine, which Alexa alluded to in her intro. So while we'll try to stay focused on elections, I think there's going to be some crossover that's inevitable. So you co-authored a study called Combating Information Manipulation, a Playbook for Elections and Beyond. Can you tell us a little bit about the study? How did it come about and who sponsored it?
Yeah, so this study, this report, was a joint project between the National Democratic Institute, the International Republican Institute, and the Stanford Internet Observatory. The three of us all collaborated on putting together this global playbook to combat information manipulation around the world. As you mentioned, these strategies, these techniques for influencing people via social media have become widespread around the world. And there's lots of different actors who are trying to combat this, whether that be governments through various kind of policy or regulatory interventions, platforms by changing, you know, the technical architecture of their infrastructure or implementing other kinds of new policies, terms of service agreements, community guidelines, but also civil society. And civil society plays a really large role in educating citizens, in advocating for certain kinds of policy interventions, for identifying and detecting mis- and disinformation campaigns online, and raising public awareness. And so this playbook was really designed to help empower civil society actors who don't necessarily have the same kind of technical expertise to be able to do the detection and identification, who don't necessarily have the same kind of funding capacity or research capacity to really get their message out there. And so we brought together a bunch of different kinds of resources, looked at a couple of different case studies to create this very thorough guide for identifying, responding to, and building resilience against mis- and disinformation.
Great. So we maybe should do a little bit of context setting then, and some definitions. And so for you, what is information manipulation exactly, and what should every citizen know about it?
Yeah. And, you know, definitions is always a really tricky part, even though it seems like it should be something really straightforward and simple. There's a lot of debate in the academic and broader research community about what terms do we use to describe a lot of these harms happening around information manipulation. So broadly speaking, I treat information manipulation as an umbrella term for misinformation, for disinformation, for malinformation. Misinformation is content that is false, but the person who is sharing it online doesn't necessarily realize that it's false. Whereas disinformation, there's intent behind spreading that false information to a broader group of people. And then malinformation is true information, but that's weaponized in a way to undermine something. So a hack and leak campaign could be an example of malinformation, because hacked documents are taken out of context and leaked and used to perpetuate some kind of goal, whether that be geopolitical, economical, so on and so forth, or, you know, just to cause chaos. So for me, I kind of think broadly of information manipulation as being this umbrella term capturing that. There's usually some element of coordination under the umbrella term of information manipulation, the way I envision it anyways, where it's not just a single person spreading something that's false, but there's some kind of coordinated network behind the message that is being spread and amplified to give it, you know, this very amplified, unrepresentative view of what's going on.
So you use a term called threat actors, which, coming from cybersecurity, that's a very standard term for somebody who is up to no good for the most part, somebody who is doing some sort of malfeasance. In this case, who are the threat actors? What are the different types, and what are their motivations?
Yeah, so there are many different kinds of threat actors, which makes this challenge around information manipulation mm-hmm. so difficult to nail down. A threat actor could be a government. You know, we've seen governments launch foreign influence operations on elections around the world to try to interfere and sway an electorate one way or another for geopolitical gain. And we've also seen governments use these tools domestically as a way to exert power and control over their own information information ecosystem as a way to silence political dissent or suppress freedom of press or freedom of speech. We've seen politicians and political parties use these tools to campaign and to generate a false sense of popularity or momentum or relevance around their ideas, particularly if they're populist political parties on the fringe of our political spectrums. These tools are very common there. We could look at conspiracy theorists, anti-vax movements. They leverage a lot of the digital affordances of social media, a lot of the features of social media to amplify their messages, to reach new audiences, and to sow distrust in the medical system, in science, and around facts about vaccine safety. You know, we can also think of people who are not necessarily ideologically motivated, but economically motivated. There's business behind spreading disinformation online. And if you can generate a lot of engagement, a lot of clicks, a lot of views on the content that you're sharing, you can generate advertising revenue. And we see people spreading disinformation to generate advertising revenue and make money. So not at all for ideological purposes, but purely for economic ones.
What are the types of attacks that you see? And are these, or tactics, I should say, and are these tactics pretty much common across the various threat actors, or are some threat actors who really favor some tactics over others?
Yeah, so that's a really great question. And the tactics are also always changing as technology continues to evolve and innovate. So some of the common tactics that we see is gaming social media algorithms. This is one way that various threat actors might try to amplify their message, generate organic engagement. They will, if you take Google search, for example, the kinds of terms that these actors use in their metadata, so that search engines, when they crawl the internet and try to organize all the information out there, they'll set up terms that the search engine web crawler will then rank very highly when people make various search requests when they're looking for information online, if they're trying to fact check something. And these actors will use terms so that their disinformation stories may get closer to the top of Google search. So people are more likely to come across this kind of information. They might use things like emotion or those kind of clickbait style headlines to generate engagement and attention, because we all know social media algorithms are very incentivized.
Provocation-based.
Exactly. And the more attention and the more engagement that you generate, the further your message goes. And so various threat actors will use these techniques, even in the kind of messages, the memes that they create, the visuals that they create, to get more people clicking, sharing, engaging, commenting on the disinformation that they're producing. Another strategy that we've seen used, deployed around the world, is the use of fake accounts and political bots. Bots are pieces of computer code that are designed to mimic human behavior. They'll like, they'll reshare, they'll retweet, sometimes they'll even comment on posts to, again, generate this false sense of popularity around a particular piece of content, around a person, or around an idea. But sometimes these accounts aren't automated. They can actually be run by humans who will use fake accounts to generate this popularity again, maybe to polarize society. They might engage in debate and play both sides of an issue to further drive divisions between society and between two sides of an issue. And sometimes the fake accounts don't even use fake accounts, but they'll use their own personal accounts. As we're seeing social media platforms take action against fake accounts that are not real people, that might have some level of automation, the various threat actors are actually getting people to use their real accounts, because then it becomes a freedom of speech issue rather than this very clear information manipulation campaign. And so this is one trend that we're seeing, and you know, a great example of how threat actors learn over time to further their own political goals while avoiding detection and avoiding takedown and avoiding the various measures that governments or platforms erect to prevent them from doing these bad things on our digital platforms and in our digital environment.
Yeah, in the paper, you mentioned that there's, you know, Twitter has a plan in place for dealing with coordinated inauthentic behavior. But part of the problem is that that's fine when it's AI bots chatting at each other in the Twitterverse. But when it's real people in discussion, it's a little harder to identify that and or track it down and or eradicate it. And it seems to me that there's sort of two primary ingredients in what you've described so far. One of which is, what do you do to drive up popularity? It's all about, you know, gaining popularity and clicks and whatnot. And the other is confusion. Right. It's not even, you can sort of, I guess you can drive people to take up a particular viewpoint by sowing confusion everywhere else in all other perspectives. I'm thinking in particular of what's going on with Russian news sources and the Ukraine, and all of the disinformation coming out of there, or much of the disinformation is trying to make it unclear what is actually going on in on the ground. I don't know if that's a fair characterization of sort of the target outcome of mis and disinformation campaigns, or, you know, if you would view it differently.
No, I think that's a really great point. And it points to a lot of kind of, or at least one of the underlying strategies of mis and disinformation is to flood the information environment, to make it so impossible to be able to determine what's true and what's false, to overwhelm people in this digital environment where we're constantly being fed news and content and information, so that we become overwhelmed and disengage and become less, you know, passionate, less empathetic. So we just care less about what is going on around us because it's just too much. It's too overwhelming. And flooding is a really common strategy. You know, what we're seeing in with the invasion in Ukraine right now and the mis and disinformation coming out of that, it's, you know, exactly like you said, these flooding techniques. And they have a long history too. We can even think of some of the earlier Russian disinformation operations around MH17 and that Malaysian flight that went down. This was, you know, really like the testing ground for the flooding strategy, where different narratives would continually emerge from different kinds of sources and take up all of the energy of the investigative community, of the cybersecurity experts, of the open source intelligence and journalist community who are trying to follow these different narratives and fact check and try to figure out what happened. It was very successful in just sowing complete confusion around what actually happened. And, you know, we're seeing these techniques today now with the ongoing invasion.
One of the things that really brings to mind is that, you know, democracies the world over are based on the presumption of an informed populace. And I think that the point there is that a populace informed by facts. And when there's this sort of swirling mass, this flooding of different perspectives, I think that that's part of what gets at, sort of erodes the possibility of a proper democracy, because you can't make an informed choice if you don't know where to turn. And you have some suggestions for what to do to address that in the elections context in the paper. I wonder if you'd like to share a few of those thoughts.
Yeah, so there's a bunch of different kinds of strategies to build resilience to mis and disinformation campaigns, to these various information manipulation techniques that we're continually seeing on social media. Some of them involve media literacy and fact-checking and coming out with good, strong public messaging towards the various event and sticking to that one consistent narrative. So as governments are dealing with a crisis, making sure that their narratives are clear and consistent. At the individual user level, we can think about education. There's been a lot of really cool initiatives on this front. You know, one that I can think of right now is games that teach people how to, you know, either be the bad guy and spread misinformation in like a game type setting, or where they are trying to combat the campaign themselves and they're like being the good guy. But it really teaches people how these techniques spread and why they're effective, and, you know, how they tap into our various cognitive biases. To make this kind of demand for disinformation very salient. And so that's like kind of some of these cool new initiatives that are popping up in the resiliency space.
You know, speaking of resiliency, there is regulation now being proposed. There's a new bill introduced by Representative Lori Tran from Massachusetts, Adam Schiff, Democrat of California, and Sean Kasten, Democrat of Illinois. This bill would establish a new FTC office called the Bureau of Digital Services Oversight and Safety, and it would give it about $500 million budget, 40% more staff to oversee the large platforms. Anybody who's more than 66, you know, million monthly users. And what they want to do is to have transparency reports outlining things like content that they removed, or even bot activity. You mentioned bots, you know, bot activity. What do you think something like that would actually be successful in helping to build that resiliency? Or do you think that's a solution, you know, to the wrong problem?
I think it's certainly helpful. One of the biggest challenges that we have right now as researchers who are trying to study the effects of these campaigns on individuals, you know, because we're really good at identifying campaigns, we're really good at tracking narratives and showing this coordination behind information manipulation. But what we're not good at is showing and measuring the actual effects that these campaigns have on people's beliefs on, and then on their behavior. Does seeing a piece of disinformation online change your opinion about something? Does it cause you to go out and vote for a different candidate? Does it cause you to go out and or not vote at all? These are really, really important questions that we're still trying to grapple with to really understand the extent of this problem. I think anecdotally, know something is really wrong with our democracy. Something feels really sour. We're increasingly polarized. And, you know, this isn't to say that social media is the cause of polarization. Polarization has been on the increase since before we've had social media, before the internet, before mobile phones. But it's made this polarization very, very visible and very, very stark. We need to understand these mechanisms better, and having more transparency and more access to data that is held by the private companies is going to be really important for research and scholarship going forward, and really important then to actually designing the proper policy responses to the problems that we're actually seeing.
Yeah, it seems like some of these companies are kind of becoming ground zero for some of the battles. I was reading an article in the Washington Post today that was talking about Facebook cuts off Russian disinformation campaign in Ukraine is the headline. And they're talking about efforts Facebook has made to stop misinformation from certain accounts, certain notional news outlets within Russia, and also to protect the accounts of prominent Ukrainians, where, you know, evidently there were efforts to hack into those and use those as sort of puppet accounts. But this is all Facebook reporting on what it's doing. And at the same time, they're under pressure by other parties to actually turn around and shut down not allow access to Facebook at all from Russia as part of the efforts of sanctions. So I don't know if this sort of puts them in the middle in a way that's not helpful, or if there are better third-party approaches, whether it's external independent researchers or external bodies from governments that could help identify problems and or lay out courses of action.
Yeah, and I think this points to just how complicated these problems around information manipulation really are today, as well as the immense power that platforms have in responding to, in combating these problems, in granting access to people and to the internet and to the contemporary information environment. They are huge players. They have huge amounts of resources and huge amounts of power and sway in to these really, really hard questions around information, around freedom of speech, around participation, and around access. I think the role of the platforms is incredibly important when we're thinking about solutions. They're going to have to play a role, but they shouldn't be the only focus of our attention. They are not going to solve a lot of the problems that we're seeing with societies and with democracy writ large when it comes to mis and disinformation. Mis and disinformation is very much tied to identity politics. It's very much tied to polarization. It's very much tied to history and culture. The narratives that tend to spread on social media are the ones that have to do with race and racism, with gender identity, with political identity. These are the narratives. When disinformation uses these narratives, it goes much farther and spreads much more deeper and resonates with us much more deeply, because at the end of the day, we are social animals, and platforms won't be able to address those long-standing issues within society, racism, sexism, xenophobia. They're not going to be able to address that with labels. They're not going to be able to address that by, taking down accounts and content in this constant game of whack-a-mole. We need to look to citizens. We need to look to governments. And we need to, I think fundamentally reimagine what the citizen role is in democracy in this contemporary digital environment.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that, at the end of the day, democracy only ever is about citizens. And the question is, how do we interact with the political machinery? And now I'm thinking over to the Freedom Convoy, and of course, no one's going to be able to see me with my scare quotes. I'm waving my fingers around when I say that. So here's a group of truckers who don't represent the views of most Canadians, who don't even represent the views of most Canadian truckers, that go and camp out in Canada's national capital for 3 weeks before being disbanded. And now there are new freedom convoys, there go the scare quotes again, being formed up and marshaling in the US to, go somewhere to say something. It can't be about mask mandates at this point, because most places don't have those anymore. So it's sort of the sense of, you can still stir people up and vector them and have it snowball in some way, even when there isn't a clearly discernible impetus. So I don't know where to go with that, other than if you can stir people up that much on indiscernible vectors, then how manipulable is the whole democratic environment from the standpoint of who's got their hand on the slider, I guess is where I'm meandering my way towards. And there's a sense that you can almost he who has the greatest control of disinformation campaigns can pick the next president of choose your country, because they will get the most voters vectored the way they want.
Yeah. And, I think this example points to two really important things. The first kind of, again, is this sense of identity rather than like an issue. that really like drives social movement, social protest in today's digital environment. You don't have to have or be campaigning for a clear thing, but if you can bring people together on a shared sense of values, whatever that may be, whether it be, you know, anti-government values, pushing back against various lockdown measures or other, these strategies are really, really effective at mobilizing people towards various causes. I think it does also still point to the interesting power dynamics of social media and of mainstream media too, and the ways in which, you know, certain audiences can come together on social media, but then get propped up by national media in, you know, the more analog form, thinking of like broadcast, like TV, radio, newspaper. Traditional media can take these messages and amplify them further generate much more attention and engagement, sympathy in some instances for these causes too. And so you can't disentangle social media from the broader media ecosystem. There's a lot of overlap and elites. Traditional media elites play a big role in disseminating a lot of the ideas that we see really go viral in a lot of these broader kind of movements, whether it be the truckers, whether it be QAnon in the United States, and a lot of the QAnon activity we saw in the lead up to the 2020 elections. You can't take traditional media out of the picture here.
Yeah, and I'm really tempted to slide down that particular slope and say, you know, at what point, where do you draw the line in between sort of social media and online websites and traditional media, right? Because any number of newspapers or other more traditional, you know, TV news sources are themselves very driven by funding requirements these days. You know, the days of the, you know, the not-profit driven, independent, well-oiled news reporting mechanism are gone.
Yeah. And, you know, I think this points to another one of those deeper problems within our society is that how do we actually fund journalism to work for democracy when so much of the content that people consume is now online and so much of it is free? Unfortunately, we need to pay our journalists to do their reporting and to do good work, but we can't fund that in a competitive way or make that kind of information competitive when everything else is so freely available and freely accessible. And it puts the whole news industry in contention with you know, the contemporary media ecosystem, where they have to generate funds for their stories. But in order to do that, they have to then play into the same systems that generate attention, that get people to click on articles and get people reading, right? And paying attention. And that's, you know, again, the same kind of stuff that we see in disinformation stories. It's the same kind of stuff that we see in all of these kinds of information manipulative campaigns. So there's really something much more deeply wrong with the way that we monetize information in today's ecosystem.
I want to just bring up something that is so topical. You know, the social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter basically deplatformed Trump. So he has gone and created his own social media platform, wait for it, called Truth Social. I say that with not the slightest hint of irony. What do you think is the impact of that? In other words, potentially lots of misinformation and disinformation is going to now swirl around one particular platform. Is that going to, in a way, solve the problem, or is the problem still there? In other words, if these platforms were to be fragmented into platforms that really cater to one group or another, does that change the dynamics of the problem we're facing, or not at all?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. And we're especially, you know, very timely because we're constantly seeing new platforms, new alternative platforms, particularly on the right, and I should say the far right, who are filling this void when accounts or content get removed from mainstream platforms for being too extreme, for spreading conspiracy theories, for spreading disinformation. They find homes in alternative spaces that don't have the same kind of thoroughness, strictness, enforcement practices around their content moderation and community guidelines. These platforms, like it's wrong to say they don't moderate at all, because they, even though they like to say they don't moderate any content, we still see them moderating things like pornography, like extreme violence, and those kinds of issues. But the question of mis and disinformation, it becomes much less clear. And you know, I think this points to bigger questions around how do we actually regulate the main players in a meaningful way, because we don't want to necessarily push people completely out so that they become moved to alternative spaces and become further radicalized, because now all of a sudden they're in an echo chamber where there are a lot of angry people who have been removed from mainstream platforms. So they're angry and they're only hearing the same things over and over. They're only hearing the same ideas, seeing the same content that fits with their pre-existing worldview, with their values. There's a lot of concern, of course, that that could cause like further radicalization and maybe even lead to things like political violence or other kinds of action as a result of this radicalization process that happens in these alternative spaces. So how do we draw that line to, you know, keep all of the bad content and bad actors off social media, but also not push them to these other kinds of extreme or alternative platforms? So far, I think that the movement from mainstream platforms to these alternative spaces has been relatively low. You know, we've seen Parler pop up in the lead up to the 2020 elections. There was a big push there to drive membership. A lot of far right and other conspiracy theorists, QAnon members moved to Parler, but it wasn't as big of a take up as I think a lot of people were expecting it to be. Whether or not Truth Social will kick off in a much more meaningful way, I think, is still up for debate. I know they had a like terrible launch where most people couldn't even register and get an account on the first day that they were supposed to go live. So whether this platform will even be able to keep up with audiences and bring people in and build this community, I think is still up for debate. But that's kind of the broad concerns around these alternative spaces. What the actual impact or effect is going to be, we still don't necessarily know.
And I think that it's pretty fair to say that there are many things that we don't yet know. And in so many ways, it's watch this space, because it's just the beginning of learning the length and breadth of the challenges here. So maybe by way of wrapping up, why don't you tell us the top two or three things that we, the general population, should take away from this in our daily lives?
Yeah, so I think the one message that I always like to get across in my work and my thinking around mis and disinformation is that it's so much deeper than the fake news or like the lie. When we're thinking about why disinformation is salient and why it spreads, a lot of it has to do with individual identity and racism and sexism and all of these kinds of other issues within society that have nothing to do with technology whatsoever. The reason why Black Lives Matter was so contentious around, especially with disinformation campaigns like around Black Lives Matter, why that was so contentious was because it was feeding into a very polarized issue within US society writ large, and this question mm-hmm. of systemic inequality and ongoing racism. That's why these disinformation campaigns usually went further and farther than other things that we've seen on the internet. And so we really need to think deeply about some of these longstanding issues within society, whether it be racism, whether it be ongoing polarization, and address those if we want to actually deal with disinformation. But all of this isn't to let social media companies off the hook for their role in creating these ubiquitous, surveillance-driven, attention-demanding technologies that really suck us in, suck up our attention, suck up our ability to engage critically with news. We need to really think deeply about the way that these technologies are designed and think about ways to design them better, to design them for democracy and democratic debate and deliberation, not for the bottom line of, shareholders in Silicon Valley. So how do we do that? And how do we deal with these kind of bigger systemic issues really underlying why disinformation goes viral in the first place?
Well, that's great. Lots to think about. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks again so much for having me. It was so great to talk to you, Leslie and Alexa. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Samantha. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this TechSequences podcast. We are Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. You can reach us by email, techsequences@techsequences.org. We'd love to hear from you to know what you thought about this episode or ideas for future episodes. TechSequences, follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and subscribe through your favorite podcasting service.